You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Salman Rushdie is the author of 11 novels, Grimus, Midnight's Children, for which he won the Booker Prize and the Best of the Booker, Shame, The Satanic Verses, Harun and the Sea of Stories, The Moor's Last Sigh, The Ground Beneath Her Feet, Fury, Shalimar the Clown, The Enchantress of Florence, and Luca and the Fire of Life, and one collection of short stories, East and West. He's also published three works of nonfiction, The Jaguar Smile, Imaginary Homelands, and Step Across This Line. He's a former president of American Pen and chair of the Pen World Voices Festival of International Literature, where I had the pleasure last spring to hear him deliver the Arthur Miller Freedom to Write lecture, in which he told the audience, "The creative act requires not only freedom, but also this assumption of freedom. If the creative artist worries if he will still be free tomorrow, then he will not be free today." In 1989, the Iranian cleric Ayatollah Khomeini declared a fatwa promising eternal life for any believer who assassinated Rushdie as punishment for the perceived blasphemies of his novel, The Satanic Verses. His new memoir, Joseph Anton, reveals how that fatwa changed Salman Rushdie's life and, one might argue, the world as we know it. The Satanic Verses, wrote Margaret Drabble, was hijacked by the exterminating angels of wrath, a wrath that still flames around us. Rushdie's Japanese translator was murdered, and another translator and his Norwegian publisher suffered bloody attacks. Across the Islamic world, protesters were killed at violent anti-Rushdie demonstrations. Joseph Anton is a clarifying book, a brutally honest book, one that tackles great moral conundrums. How do we respond to attacks on who we are and what we believe in our deepest core to be true? Rushdie's book, The Satanic Verses, for which he suffered 10 years of hiding under the fatwa, which was officially lifted in 1998, is still in print in 46 languages, a small victory in an ongoing battle. And Joseph Anton, the memoir we will discuss today, has just been published in 17 different languages and has received rave reviews from coast to coast. Last night, as you heard, Salman Rushdie received the LAPL Literary Award, and the Los Angeles Public Library and the Library Foundation of Los Angeles is proud to honor him here today. Please welcome Salman Rushdie. Congratulations again on the award.
Well, thank you.
And on this magnificent book, which is one of the most absorbing, beautiful memoirs I've ever read. I thought it would be great if we could start, if you would be willing to read an excerpt about how the book got its title and you got your name. There we go.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, let's read this. I think it's self-explanatory. He needed a name. The police told him in Wales. The book is written in the third person. His own name was useless. It was a name that could not be spoken, like Voldemort. in the not-yet-written Harry Potter books. He could not rent a house with it or register to vote, because to vote you needed to provide a home address, and that, of course, was impossible. To protect his democratic right to free expression, he had to surrender his democratic right to choose his government. He needed to choose a name pretty pronto and then talk to his bank manager and get the bank to agree to accept checks signed with the false name so that he could pay for things without being identified. The new name was also for the benefit of his protectors. They needed to get used to it, to call him by it at all times, when they were with him and when they weren't, so that they didn't accidentally let his real name slip when they were walking or running or going to the gym or the supermarket and blow his cover. The prot, that's slang for protection, the prot had a name, Operation Malachite. He did not know why the job had been given the name of a green stone, and neither did they. They were not writers. And the and the reasons for names were not important to them. But now it was his turn to rename himself. Probably better not to make it an Asian name, Stan said. Stan's one of the police officers. People put two and two together sometimes. So he was to give up his race as well. He would be an invisible man in whiteface. He thought of writers he loved and tried combinations of their names. Vladimir Joyce. Marcel Beckett. Franz Stern. He made lists of such combinations, but all of them sounded ridiculous. Then he found one that did not. He wrote down side by side the first names of Conrad and Chekhov. And there it was, his name for the next 11 years. Joseph Anton. Jolly good, Stan said. You won't mind if we call you Joe. In fact, he did mind. He soon discovered that he detested the abbreviation for reasons he did not fully understand. After all, why was Joe so much worse than Joseph? He was neither one, and they should have struck him as equally phony or equally suitable. But Joe grated on him almost from the beginning. Nevertheless, that monosyllable was what the protection officers found it easiest to master and remember. So Joe, it had to be. He had spent his life naming fictional characters. Now, by naming himself, he had turned himself into a sort of fictional character as well. Conrad Chekhov wouldn't have worked, but Joseph Anton was someone who might exist, who now did exist. Conrad, the translingual creator of wanderers, of voyagers into the heart of darkness, of secret agents in a world of killers and bombs, and of at least one immortal coward hiding from his shame. And Chekhov, the master of loneliness and of melancholy, of the beauty of an old world destroyed, like the trees in a cherry orchard, by the brutality of the new. Chekhov, whose three sisters believed that real life was elsewhere and yearned eternally for a Moscow to which they could not return. These were his godfathers now. It was Conrad who gave him the motto to which he clung as if to a lifeline in the long years that followed. In the now unacceptably titled The Nigger of the Narcissus, the hero, a sailor named James Waite, stricken with tuberculosis on a long sea voyage, is asked by a fellow sailor why he came aboard knowing that he was unwell. I must live till I die, mustn't I? Waite replies. In his present circumstances, the question felt like a command. Joseph Anton, he told himself, you must live till you die. Mm.
Thank you. So you had to find a way to write about this formless time, this amoral universe that you were thrown into, where your life was taken apart. I was just reading Midnight's Children, which the fictional character speaks in the first person, and here you have the memoir, which you're in the third person.
Non-fictional character speaking in the third person.
Could you talk a little bit just about how you came to that decision?
Well, I mean, I do think of those two books in a funny way as being related. You know, that, I mean, Midnight's Children, after all, is a novel that to some degree is drawn from certainly memories of childhood. You know, I mean, Celine, the hero's life is much less like mine as he grows up, but I think certainly when he's a child, you know, he essentially lives in my house and goes to my school and has some friends who are at least composites of people I used to know. So there, if you like, there I've got a novel at the very beginning of my career, which takes real life and turns it into fiction. And here I've got a work of nonfiction which I try to write like a novel, in which I don't turn it into fiction, but it's written as if it was. So these two things, I don't know, these two books seem to me to be looking at each other across a very long distance.
Interesting.
You know, looking at each other suspiciously.
and the third person, you found it liberating.
I just found it easier. I tried writing it in the first person.
You
I
mean, did?
When I started, I thought, obviously, you know, write it in the first, it's an autobiography, write it in the first person. And I just didn't like it. You know, me, I thought, shut up. You know? I really didn't like the tone of voice. And I mean, as you say, I have written first-person narratives without any problem, but it's just felt different when the first person is somebody you've made up rather than yourself.
This gave you a certain distance too.
Yeah. One of the reasons for not writing the book for so long was also to have that distance.
Right.
You know, was to be able to reflect in tranquility, as the saying goes. You know, I also felt that the me that the book's about, which after all is a much younger self, you know, like at the time of the fatwa, I was 41 years old, you know, so it's 24 years ago. I did feel that me was a little bit not quite who I am
now
after all this happened to me, you know. So I felt that I just wanted to suggest that the me that's writing the book is not identical with the me being written about.
Yeah, I think that really works. You know,
that too.
Right after what they called the Rushdie Affair in Britain began, there were polls that showed that a large majority of the British public felt that you should apologize for this offensive book. And they accused you of doing it on purpose, which was kind of a code. And you write about being genuinely perplexed when you first were accused of the book being offensive. Could you talk a little bit about why you were perplexed and what are the implications of that phrase, doing it on purpose? Could you unpack that for us?
First of all, you know, obviously I did it on purpose. How do you work for 5 years on a book by accident?
I guess they didn't know that, right?
You know, the idea that I would somehow unintentionally produce a novel.
Automatic writing, sort of.
It seemed like it's an odd accusation. You know, the question is, what do they mean by it?
Right.
And what they meant, of course, was some kind of insult. And I've always said, you know, if I want to insult people, I could do it much faster than that. It doesn't take five. Yeah,
right.
It takes two sentences. It doesn't take 5 years and a quarter of a million words.
It takes a gesture. Yeah.
Let's not talk about your personal habits here.
Deal.
So there was an assumption. The way in which this book was very rapidly turned into something much cruder than a novel, it was the way in which it was sort of sloganized and reduced to just, you know, that strange thing, an insult. That's what people thought I'd done on purpose. I know that there have been many occasions since where people, both Muslim readers and non-Muslim readers, have read the book and written to me and said, could you just explain to me where the problem is?
Because
I don't seem to be able to see where the problem is.
Even Iranian booksellers who had the book before saw no problem.
No, I mean, I had this strange experience that my previous novel, Shame, had been translated into Farsi in Iran without my agreement. You know, pirated translation, published, and had then been given a prize as the best novel translated into Farsi that year. And just for the record, I never got the prize. if there was an object, you know, I didn't receive it, and if there was some form of check attached to it, you know, that didn't show up either. But apparently, it won this prize, and so when the Satanic Verses came out, I guess, there's one or two English language bookstores in Tehran and elsewhere, there's not many. But they thought, well, you know, he's okay. He must be okay because they gave him a prize. So they obviously think he's cool. And so they imported, you know, I mean, I don't know, we'll have a couple of hundred copies of the Satanic Verses into Iran, which were then on sale openly for 6 months.
Wow.
Without creating any kind of fuss at all, you know, and then the Ayatollah Khomeini said what he said, and
but he never saw the book, apparently.
No, of course he didn't sell the book.
He never saw the book.
He was really deeply unwell, and he, in fact, died a couple of months later. So he was essentially on his deathbed, and he was certainly wasn't reading 600-page novels in English at the time.
So you suspected from the very beginning that the fatwa came from the top down, not the bottom up. And how soon did you know that to be true? I mean, then it was also, how did it serve him, how did it serve Khomeini, and how did it serve the British clerics in London too?
Well, I mean, you know, this is all one of the reasons why I've been saying that these things are political, not theological. You know, is you have to look at the politics of it. And at that particular moment, the Iranian Revolution was in a little trouble because of its catastrophic war with Iraq, in which huge casualties, and it had really a generation of young men lost, you know, hundreds of thousands of casualties, and so the revolution was probably at its least popular moment since it had happened a decade earlier. And Khomeini, I guess, was looking for a way of rallying the troops, and that turned out to be me, to my misfortune. And I mean, I've often thought that if the book had been published a year later, or if he had passed away 6 months earlier, you know, we wouldn't be having this conversation. I mean, I think it was just bad timing, to put it mildly. In Britain, it was a very interesting phenomenon that if you look at the politics of ethnic minority groups in England in the previous 20 years, they had more or less nothing to do with religion. I mean, they were kind of left-wing socialist politics, basically. I mean, and people didn't call themselves, you know, Muslim or Hindu or whatever. The term that was used was British Asian, you know, and that went across religious boundaries. And the religious boundaries were not seen as a way of separating these groups. Occasionally, there were divisions which were usually caused by political events in the Indian subcontinent. So that, for instance, in the early 70s, when what became Bangladesh fought its war of secession from Pakistan, suddenly this war was fought in London at the level of Indian restaurants. You know, so the places were identified as Pakistani or Bangladeshi. And, you know, it really was a problem if you got that wrong. But in general, there wasn't a religious sectarian division. And this was one of the occasions that essentially the mosques in England used to try and exert control over the community, which they had lost, they didn't have. And actually, it was quite successful.
And they were relentless. So it was quite a story. Your friend Hanif Qureshi wrote, he said, "I didn't see the satanic versus controversy coming. I was flabbergasted. How could a community that I identified with turn against a writer who was one of its most articulate voices?"
Yeah.
I mean, it was...
Yeah. Well, you know, I didn't... It was upsetting, yeah. There was one story which I have to say I take a certain mischievous pleasure in, which is that a group of Irish construction workers who had been employed to work on a gigantic new mosque being built in the British Midlands sent a letter to me saying that during the course of the construction, when they were digging, laying the foundations and pouring the concrete and so on, that they'd dropped a copy of the Satanic Verses.
Over 600 pages, and I did not. That is not in the book.
Into the photo.
I don't think you got that
in
there.
Did I put it in?
No, you didn't.
Oh, I thought I did put it in. But anyway, there you are. This is kind of.
That's
you know,
a great. That's
a an
great
extra. Extra. But anyway, there it is. There's this huge mosque built on my novel.
I love it. What are the among the many delightful parts of this book? And it's really. An incredible read. What you write about your childhood, about your parents, the childhood of the man who was forced to become the character, Joseph Anton, and you write about how storytelling was really your birthright. Tell us a little bit about the stories that you grew up listening to as a child. Of course, last night we learned that also included great works of Dell Comics, but the stories that your father read to you as a child.
Yes, well, I mean, of course, Superman and Batman were certainly...
From the library.
From a little lending library around the corner where in Bombay where I lived, you could go and buy all this American crap.
Which served you well.
Absolutely.
Right.
In fact, there are people I've seen who seriously advance the theory that Midnight's Children is somehow based on the X-Men.
Someone's PhD thesis.
You know, because of they all have special powers and so on. So yes, it's a kind of another story of mutants. You know, so if somebody wants to make a movie, I'd be available for discussions later on.
But of the works
Midnight's X-Men.
Of literature.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think one of the things that's the kind of birthright of people who grow up in the Indian subcontinent is this extraordinary group of what are called wonder tales, you know, and that's of which, of course, I mean, the Arabian Nights is the best known, but and actually a thing that people perhaps don't know is that many of the stories which were collected finally in Arabic in the Arabian Nights are stories which originated in India. Mm. Because at the time, there was a collection, there's a now lost collection of stories, which was written in Farsi, which was the court language at the time. It was called Hazar Afsana, which means 1,000 stories. And this particular anthology of stories gradually made its way west, you know, into Persia, and through Persia into the Arabic-speaking world, where it was translated into Arabic, and many of those stories became the stories that were collected in the Arabian Nights, and then at a certain point, the Scheherazade story is put around that, and the book takes the form that we now have. But many of the actual stories within the story are Indian in origin. So we had those, and then there were animal fables, you know, the Panchatantra fables. There were stories of, you know, sort of, kind of, as one might say, magic realist stories of great heroes like the Hamzanama and the Adventures of Hatim Thai, all these collections where mighty heroes would cut ogres in half and marry fairy princesses and all of that, have winged horses and flying carpets. So you grew up with that as the basic world of story. And then some Western stories arrived too. I mean, Alice in Wonderland was there, but oddly, Winnie the Pooh was not. Mm. You know, so I only found out about Winnie the Pooh when I was much older. And but the Alice stories were colossally important to me.
And as well, so you grew up in a secular Muslim family in Bombay. We won't call it Mumbai, as you instructed us last night. Your father was a scholar of Islam.
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit about how the structures of both Hinduism and Islam shaped your thinking as you grew up, kind of structures.
Well, one of the great things about polytheism is that the stories are better.
More to choose from. Yeah.
And so, I mean, Hinduism, of course, is an inexhaustible storehouse of great stories. And you know, if you're going to steal the good stuff. You know, and so I did certainly, for instance, one of the characteristics of the elephant-headed god Ganesh is that he is a patron of literature. I mean, according to legend, Ganesh was so much an admirer of poetry that when the semi-mythological bard, the Homer figure, Vyasa, sat down to write the Mahabharata, Ganesh came and sat at his feet and acted as the scribe.
Mm.
You know, so ever since then, there's a relationship between Ganesh and literature. So then Salim in Midnight's Children has a very big nose. And I thought, you know, that gave him a connection to an elephant-headed god. So those kinds of narrative have always sort of wound in and out of my stuff. And the Islamic stories, I mean, I just thought the thing that interested me is, given that I was a historian by training, that the story of the origin story of Islam is the only one of the great world religions that takes place inside recorded history. You know, so instead of having legends about the origin of Christianity, which is essentially what we have, you have actual hard facts. You have mm-hmm. historical facts. You know about the social and economic conditions of Arabia at the time. You know about its transition from a nomadic society to a settled urban society, from nomadic matriarchal communities to urbanized patriarchal communities, with the changes that makes in family life. And we know about the Prophet himself and how, you know, he was an orphan and he came from a family that you know had fallen on harder hard times economically and you know, he made a good marriage, and then he was a merchant for his, on his wife's behalf, and very successful, and didn't actually begin to be a prophet until he was 40 years old, but had a kind of mystical tendency and would often go off, you know, onto this hill outside Makkah in order to be alone. And at a certain point, when he's on this hill, this archangel appears to him, you know, and this other narrative begins. I mean, so I just thought, you study that historically, you look at how how the text of the Quran connects to circumstances in the history of the country at the time, the region at the time, and you learn a lot, you know. I mean, to give you just one example, on these merchant trips, on these caravan trails, of course, the oasis becomes a central location where people would stop and, you know, spend the night or whatever. And very often the oases in Arabia were run by Christians. They were run by this sect of Christians called Nestorian Christians. And Nestorian Christianity is a kind of desert variation of Christianity. So some of the Bible stories are altered to suit desert conditions. So for instance, the story of Jesus, in according to Nestorian Christianity, relocates his birth to an oasis under a palm tree, you know. And in the Quran, the account of the birth of Jesus in the chapter called Maryam, Mary, is exactly that, that he's born in an oasis under a palm tree. Now, if you happen to know that the person through whom this book came to be was somebody who was traveling on these trips and learning these stories from these stops in the oases where these versions were the ones available, I mean, it's not so hard to join the dots. But then, of course, that's blasphemy, because this is the word of God, and God wasn't listening to Nestorian Christians at an oasis, you know, etc. So this is the problem. When you are deprived of the ability to historicize the stories, it seems to me you lose a lot of what's most interesting about them, you know? And that's what I thought. It's out of that spirit that I thought I was writing. Seemed like a perfectly serious thing to do.
And you had encountered the story of the Satanic Verses when you were studying Islam in a private tutorial, right?
At Cambridge. I mean, I did a history degree at Cambridge, and in my final year, one of the special subjects that I studied was about Muhammad and the rise of Islam, and that's where this strange story, the so-called anecdote, the incident of the Satanic Verses, that's where I came across it. And I mean, all it, you know, it's...
And you stored it away.
I stored it away. I thought, good story, you know.
And it really was.
I say in the book, you know, 20 years later, I find out how good a story it was. Yeah. You know? But it's not a story I made up.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And it exists within many of the most authoritative traditions of the Prophet.
I loved reading about that in the book. That was so interesting. During the years of the Fatwa, among the things you wrote a monograph about the Wizard of Oz, which I loved, which is also a great story, as you point out, about the power of friendship. And so there was so much friendship and kindness and bravery that was shown to you from various publishers, from friends, and all sorts of great writers appear in this book. Hanif Qureshi, Graham Greene, Margaret Atwood, Harold Pinter, Michael Ondaatje, Ian McEwan, among your good friends, Christopher Hitchens, Susan Sontag, Carlos Fuentes. And there were even 100 Muslim writers who wrote on your behalf. And yet there were some Western writers, particularly some on the left, and this really surprised me reading the book, who did not support you, quite publicly did not. And I wondered how they could not understand what was at stake in this scenario.
You'll have to ask them. There weren't a lot, you know, but there were, some of them were prominent. And I mean, the one that really took me by surprise was John Berger.
Yeah, that was the one that really surprised me.
Because I mean, also because I knew John Berger, and I always, you know, I always thought we were on perfectly good terms. And in fact, when this was quite soon after the fatwa, and I was staying in some appalling sort of damp farm cottage in mid Wales, and the police went out and got me the newspaper. Then I got the newspapers, and I saw on the front page that there was, it flagged that there was an article by John Berger inside, and I thought, oh good, you know, assuming that it would be supportive. And when I turned to it and discovered that he was attacking me in very, you know, very ungenerous language, I was really shocked.
So would you, one analysis is like that someone who is such a staunch defender of like the masses couldn't believe that like the Arab street would be wrong?
Well, I think the masses can't be wrong.
The masses can't be wrong, is that
that's
it?
That's a Marxist rule.
Yeah.
You know, the people can't be incorrect.
You know. Doesn't serve him well.
And I know the thing is, you know, John Berger and I have quite a few friends in common, and many of, and all of them were horrified that
imagine.
He had written this, and all of them called him up and said, "What the hell do you think you're talking about?" You know, and he immediately clammed up. Mm. He wouldn't talk about it, and from that day to this, he's refused to discuss it. Mm. So you know, you hope he's embarrassed. You know?
Someday, find
but,
out.
But probably not. You know, I mean,
no. During the first years of the fatwa, you were counseled to keep a low profile,
yeah, the
remain
first,
silent.
First 12 months, really.
First the 12
worst.
Months.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, you had. I mean, I think it's really hard for us to understand. And you really found a language to convey this. Like you did not know. We know now how long it lasted, but in the moment, you did not know. Mm. Would it last a few months? Would it last years? It was like, as Borges had that fabulous passage about the pompous, like you can't capture it in one photograph. But you were you wanted it to stop, and you even talk about, you also wanted to be liked. You wanted to make some conciliatory gesture, so maybe it would stop. So, if there was you did make a gesture, and it's a really interesting part of the book because. What it taught you was really profound, and it really influenced your stance in the later years of that time. Could you talk a little bit about that gesture?
Well, there's two things to it. One is that this was about, I guess, 2 years into the narrative, so like the late part of 1990, and I wasn't in very good shape. I mean, I was reading my journals of the period, and it becomes quite clear that the person writing the journals isn't in great mental shape. You know, I'm very, to put it mildly, very depressed. And meanwhile, there was a lot of external pressure of the sort you described to in some way appease or, you know, assuage the feelings of or do something.
Yeah.
You know, and there was very much this suggestion that, you know, you broke it, you fix it, and that somehow the responsibility for bringing this to a close was mine.
Not only finding where you were going to live, but bringing it to a close.
Yeah, somehow solving the problem.
Solving the problem.
Know? And the only way it could be solved is by a kind of surrender, if you like. And the fact that I refused to withdraw the book, which there were people saying I should do, was called arrogance, right? And so that created a character for me as this arrogant, self-regarding person who, of course, was making lots of money because the book was selling a lot, and that was wrong too. So there was all of that, and you know, you can imagine with somebody who's already in a very unhappy state of mind, but external pressure was telling.
And also being accused of, you know, costing the British government money on top of that because you needed to be protected, which you did.
Yes, I mean, perish the thought that the British government should have to spend money to protect a British
citizen
against international terrorism. anyway, all of that. And at some point, this all led to my being essentially sort of suckered into a meeting with a group of Islamic leaders who were promising that if I came along and said the right things, that they would act to solve the problem by telling everybody that it was over now. And, you know, I wanted to believe that.
Right.
You know, and so I allowed myself to get into the situation where they gave me this piece of paper to sign, and I realized that the piece of paper included a declaration of faith. And I'm, you know, the least religious person I know. Now that Christopher's dead. I mean, before that, I was the second least religious person I knew. And And yet, I found myself signing the document, you know, in this spirit of peacemaking, if you like. And immediately I did it. I just felt, I knew I'd made the biggest mistake of my life. You know, and I left this room where this meeting had taken place. And so my body knew it before my mind. I immediately started, I started throwing up. I was really, really sick. And then all my close friends told me I was insane, and I thought they were probably right. And my sister, who I'm very, very close to, called me and said, "What the hell do you think you're doing?" Because I mean, she knows who I am, you know. And she said, "Are you have you gone mad?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, maybe."
Maybe so.
Anyway, it was clearly a kind of rock bottom moment because I thought I'd sort of betrayed myself at that moment because I'd said something I didn't believe. And of course, it didn't work at all because all those people, I had been deliberately led into a trap. They weren't going to do any of that. You know, they weren't going to go out there and put their own necks on the line by saying, "It's fine, we've made peace." They didn't do anything. So it wasn't even effective. But more than that, I felt that I lost a lot of self-respect at that time. But in retrospect, looking back at it, and one of the things I try and say in the book is that I think it was a pivotal moment for me, not just in this story, but in my life, because it just showed me, don't do that again.
And it showed you what, you talk about the failure of quietism. I love this quote. You say, an invisible, silenced man was an empty space into which others could pour their prejudices, their agendas, their wrath. The fight against fanaticism needed visible faces, audible voices, and he would be quiet no longer. He would try to become a loud, invisible man.
So
it really changed your tack.
I thought, if you do something weak, you're treated like a weakling.
Right.
And it seemed to me after that, I thought, the hell with this, you know? I'm not going to make compromises about things that there must be no compromise about. You know, enough with like appeasement and apology and mollification and the hell with all that. You know, there's something to fight about here, and I'm going to try and be in that fight.
And did that start to lift you out of the depression?
Yes, I immediately felt better. Mm-hmm. I immediately felt better because I felt clearer in my head. And I no longer, the chapter which talks about this in the book is called The Trap of Wanting to be Loved. And I had this crazy idea in those early days that I could just explain myself out of this. That I could just say, look, if you just let me explain, I'll tell you what the book's really about, and you will understand that I'm not a bad guy, I'm actually a nice guy, you've made a terrible mistake, and now that you've understood that, let's all go home and we can all get on. You know, and I just thought I could actually write my way out of it, you know, by just explaining well. And I mean,
that was
idiocy, right? And just to be released from that trap, to think, okay, there are going to be people who don't like me. And, you know, guess what? I don't like them much either. And it's okay. I don't care. I'm going to say what I have to say, and I'm going to argue what I have to argue, and if you don't like it, tough. Deal with it, you know? And that clarity arrived out of that hitting the bottom of the barrel moment. And I think has made me the person that I was then able to be, because you have to ask yourself this question when you're in a jam like this, you know, is it worth it? It's only a damn book, withdraw the book, get on with your life.
And it was affecting, you know, your son, all your wife, everyone around you, so.
And I found that I could not think like that. Mm-hmm. I found that I could not do that. I couldn't make that act of surrender. And then I thought, well, why not? What's so important? And the answer to what's so important is something that I try and say in the book, and it's something actually that Christopher Hitchens said in quite separately, independently, with no conferring, that what we both came to feel about this was that it was a struggle in which everything we cared about was on one side and everything we hated most was on the other side. That, you know, on one side, bigotry, intolerance, violence, narrow-mindedness, ignorance, including ignorance of their own tradition, you know, and on the other side, you know, literature, imagination, and this larger idea, liberty, and I thought, okay, you know, I thought you didn't choose the fight, you know, the fight chose me in a way, but it's the right fight, you know, and if that's the fight I'm in, you know, do your best. Fight it.
Well, when you talk about, yes, we agree. Do you think that this country is the most likely place for progressive Muslim values to really take root?
Yes, I do believe that, because I think the Muslim community here is quite sophisticated. You know, I mean, in England, for instance, there's one of the historical problems is that much of the migration from the Indian subcontinent came from very remote rural areas, you know, of India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. And as a result, the communities, they were essentially village communities with a kind of non-cosmopolitan, non-urban mindset, which came and settled in England. And I think that created substantial problems of adjustment and frictions and so on. I mean, the community here is much more, let's say, middle class. It's better educated. It's more, and I think it's much more, to use a complicated word, integrated. You know, and so I do think it's easier here. Yes.
And maybe this community and other progressive Muslim communities will be able to be in communication with the progressive elements of the Arab Spring, because that's going to be a long process.
Yeah,
right?
Maybe. I don't know. One of the things that I learned from the study of history was don't speculate about the future. Because it's hard enough to understand the past.
Hear, hear.
And the future, one of the things about the future is that it will always surprise you. You know, I've always thought this whole science of futurology, you know, that exists now is the science of being wrong about the future. because that just simply never happens. You know, if on December the 31st, 1988, I had suggested to you that 1 year later the Soviet Union would not exist. It just would not exist. That Nelson Mandela would be free, etc. I mean, you would have thought, never happened. Can't happen.
Stunning.
You know? And yet, boom, there it was. In 1989, it's an extraordinary year. You know, Mandela, the Soviet Union, Tiananmen, you know.
And you watched it, you observed it under a fatwa, right?
Yeah, there was this moment when I was watching Mandela walking to freedom on TV. It was a complicated moment. I just thought, good for you.
Your moment would come. We're going to open up to you in just a moment. Salman, I thought it would be wonderful if you could just conclude this portion of our program with reading this beautiful passage from the book. I loved that so much.
Oh, yeah. All right. At the heart of the dispute over the satanic verses, he said, behind all the accusations and abuse was a question of profound importance. Who shall have control over the story? Who should have the power not only to tell the stories with which and within which we all lived, but also to say in what manner those stories may be told? For everyone lived by and inside stories, the so-called grand narratives. The nation was a story. The family was another. Religion was a third. As a creative artist, he knew that the only answer to the question was everyone and anyone has or should have that power. We should all be free to take the grand narratives to task, to argue with them, satirize them, and insist that they change to reflect the changing times. We should speak of them reverently, irreverently, passionately, caustically, or however we chose. That was our right as members of an open society. In fact, one could say that our ability to retell and remake the story of our culture was the best proof that our societies were indeed free. In a free society, the argument over the grand narratives never ceased. It was the argument itself that mattered. The argument was freedom. But in a closed society, those who possessed political or ideological power invariably tried to shut down these debates. We will tell you the story, they said, and we will tell you what it means. We will tell you how the story is to be told, and we forbid you to tell it any other way. if you do not like the way we tell the story, then you are an enemy of the state or a traitor to the faith. You have no rights. Woe betide you. We will come after you and teach you the meaning of your refusal. The storytelling animal, that's us, must be free to tell his tales.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Salman. We have two microphones, and we have time for some questions. So.
Right, microphone.
I wanted to ask about the significance of a name. I'm an atheist Jew who spent a lot of time abroad, sometimes in Islamic countries, and I didn't mind if people gave me other names. I've been called... in Sudan, Layla, and other places, Jamila. I'm checked in even here under one name, but when I contribute to the library, I contribute to the library under a completely different name. Talk a little bit about what it's like, though, when you had to take another name because you were being persecuted and not out of choice.
Well, I actually hated it. And one of the reasons why I made it the title of the book is just to dramatize to readers what a strange thing it is to be forced to give up your name. You know, and just to ask you to imagine what it would be like if that was, as you say, if that were not a choice. You know, there's another thing, which is that my own actual name, Rushdie, was also in a way an invention. That my father had invented it as a family name. Because in an old-fashioned Muslim family, you don't necessarily have a permanent family name. You take your father's first name as your last name. So my father was called Anis, so I would have been, Salman Anis or Salman ibn Anis if it was Arabic. And he thought that, in the modern world, you should have a family name, you should have a surname. You know. So he picked this name, Rushdie, because of his admiration for the 12th century Spanish Muslim philosopher Ibn Rushd, known in the West as Averroes, the great scholar of Aristotle. Extraordinarily, in the 12th century, which is one of the great moments of the battle between progressives and conservatives in the Muslim world, or the great battle between those who believed in interpretation and those who were literalists, Ibn Rushd was very much on the modernizing side, So he had chosen from 800 years ago the name of a philosopher whose ideas, in a way, were the flag that I had to fly under, And I thought my father really got that right. Amazingly, for a long time I didn't know that he'd made up this name, So the question of naming, I think, has been quite important in my life. Both that's a choice. This was not a choice. And I just say one other kind of sort of silly thing, but I had always wanted to write a book that had somebody's name as the title. I thought, David Copperfield.
Lord Jim.
Huckleberry Finn. Robinson Crusoe. I thought, those are titles. those are books that know what they're about, Tom Jones.
Need no further explanation. Yeah,
Daniel Deronda, Silas Marner,
It's really
it's a fantastic list, Jane Eyre.
That's good.
We know what these books are about. And I thought, I want to have one of those, and I finally got one.
Over there.
I'd like to thank you, first of all, because your prose has allowed me to appreciate other cultures and change my life, short of going and living there.
Well, thank you.
And I say this with the knowledge that I studied in Poland during the communist years, and I was there in 1981 and 1982 during martial law. Mm-hmm. I've seen how things can change. I'm just curious, given your 20 years, I want to let you know it's not a waste of time. It's enlightened a lot of us. But do you think you're ever going to write in Farsi and perhaps change minds on...
No, because I'm not from there. I mean, I'm not Iranian. I'm from India. I don't speak Farsi. and it's too late to learn, really, I think.
There's Pimsleur tapes, you know.
I mean, the truth is that, my mother tongue is Urdu, and I speak Indian languages. I speak Hindi and Urdu and so on, but I don't, to be honest, I don't speak them well enough to write in them anymore. And I think English will have to do for me. I mean, some of these books were, as I say, were translated into Farsi. Doesn't seem to have made a revolution there, not of the kind I would wish. But Shame, as I say, was translated into Farsi. There actually is a Samizdat edition of the Satanic Verses in Farsi. I mean, I was approached by a group of Iranians living outside Iran, who asked me if I would permit them to do that. And I said, yeah, do, go ahead. And initially it was a print edition, in two volumes, in fact, and apparently was brought into the country by various people and circulated. Then it was used by radio broadcasts of opposition groups outside Iran broadcasting into Iran, so that people could actually hear it broadcast. And that happened. And now, of course, we have the internet. So now you can actually find a Farsi translation of the book online if you know where to look. And so in that sense, yes, I mean, I don't speak Farsi, but my work exists in Farsi. And I think people, I mean, I've had quite a lot of letters from Iranian people saying that they really liked it. So that's nice, but I mean, I don't flatter myself that it's going to change that much. You know? Well, let's see.
Over there?
Being an Angeleno, I'm going to take our conversation to the movies.
Okay.
I was really excited to see the trailer for Midnight's Children.
Yes.
I'm really excited about Deepa being the director. But the relationship between the author, the screenwriter, and the director is a complicated one.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if there's anything that you had to let go in order for this movie to come to fruition. Or there are many fans of this book, I'm sure, in this room.
Know.
Are we going to be disappointed about anything? And if you're into the X-Men idea, I have some ideas.
All right, well, we'll talk about those later. But it was actually the most easy collaboration that you could imagine. You know, and I think both of us were a little scared at the beginning because we were friends, and you know, that doesn't necessarily mean you have a good working relationship, and you know, it was a project that was very important to her, and obviously it was a project that was very important to me. And so I remember the first time we sat down to talk about the adaptation and how to approach the screenplay. I think we were both quite tense about it. And I had said to her that I was going to write down a sequence of scenes that I thought needed to be in the film in order for it to be a film of Midnight's Children. You know? And I said, why don't you do the same thing and then we talk about it. So we both had these lists. And we exchanged the lists, and they were basically the same list, you know. Not 100%, but you know, more than 90%, the same list. And at that point, I think both of us relaxed, because we realized we're trying to make the same film, you know. And sometimes in a collaboration, people are pulling in slightly different directions, and that creates tension. And that wasn't the case. And so, for instance, one of the first things I suggested on that day, which will shock some people who are fond of the book, I said we have to drop the frame narration. You know, because in the book, Salim is telling his story retrospectively to this girl, Padma, who works in the pickle factory. And I said, you know, that's a literary device. In a film, if you're constantly interrupting the action to go somewhere where two people are talking about the action, you're breaking the audience's emotional connection with the story all the time. You know, and we can't do it. So I said, let's drop it, and just tell the story straight out. Instead of it being Salim talking to her, it's the film talking to you. Mm. You know, and she said, you know, I was going to suggest that, but I thought you wouldn't like it. And so it was like that. Our dialogue. It was not at all difficult. It was difficult because the task of the adaptation is very difficult. You know, I mean, the first script was, you know, it would have been a 5-hour film. The first script was like 250 pages.
How long is the final film?
It's 2.25 hours. Two and a quarter hours, and then interminable credit titles. The credit titles go on for another kind of 12 or 13 minutes, and I strongly recommend that everybody gets up and leaves. But the actual film is 2.25 hours.
I think we have time for one more question, actually.
Just to say about the film that we have now, I mean, literally in the last week, finally settled the U.S. distribution question.
Oh, fantastic.
And so we're just waiting to sort out exactly when it'll be released. But now the film does have a distributor, and it will be out shortly.
Okay.
It's not a question. It's just I wanted to tell you that I'm reading your book. I realized that you wrote Luca in a really, really hard time. And that's the book that my son and I first read together. It's fantastic. Mm. Thank you so much.
Well, you know, these two books that I wrote for my two sons, I mean, the secret, you know, one is always being asked, what is your favorite book of yours that you've ever written? And the official answer to that is I don't choose between them, you know. They're just all the books I wrote. But the real answer is that I like those two books best because they have this kind of intimate thing that they were written for my two sons. And fortunately, they like them.
Such a miracle that you were able to write during that time. Such a gift.
Well, Haroon was, you know, the one that was written for in the middle of the really worst time. Luca, I mean, things have got better by then. But there we are. Yes, so the two of them, I think, I hope, go well together. I thought about Lewis Carroll writing Through the Looking Glass. I thought, that's tough, you know. if you've written Alice in Wonderland and it's already this kind of classic, and then you've got to write volume two.
But it works.
I mean, it actually, Through the Looking Glass pulls it off. So that was a sort of inspiration for me, because I didn't want the second book, Luca, to be disappointing after people had liked the first one. You know, so
tough order.
Yeah. So yeah.
One last one.
Going back a little bit to what you were talking about, the X-Men, and also related to the Midnight's Children adaptation, you said that you heard some people talking about Midnight's Children as like the mutants, but there's a huge group within the geek community who believe that that awful television show Heroes is Midnight Children dumbed down severely.
And so yes, I heard that. I heard that too. And I haven't watched any of it, so maybe I should, just in case I can sue them. And then, you know, I mean, it's wonderful what happens in the movies. We showed the film at the Telluride Film Festival, and I was walking out of the theater and I heard somebody say, you know, it's like Forrest Gump with brown people. All I could think of to say is, I wrote Midnight's Children before Forrest Gump. So really, so Forrest Gump is Midnight's Children with white people.
That's ridiculous. Salman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the award, and we look forward to seeing Midnight's Children.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.